Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, can everybody hear me all right? I don't have very good microphone karma. So. Especially it amplifies my coughs. So you've probably heard quite a bit of different teachings today already. And I mean, in principle, it's the same teachings, about the Buddha's teachings, but each one of us has our own particular view of it, our own angle on it, our own experience of it. So hopefully I don't say anything contrary to what Ajahn Dunn has said. It's, as it were, just my angle on things, you see. So on all these teachings, I mean, ideally we use them for contemplation and reflection, not to be just believed in, but to use them as themes for contemplation. So sometimes, you know, hearing certain, even familiar teachings from a different perspective can be very helpful. We get a new angle on it, a new perspective on it. I spent a few years with Ajahn Chah in Thailand, and if I look back at his teachings, I mean, many times he repeated the same thing over and over again, the basic fundamental teachings of the Buddha, but most of the time I didn't understand what he's talking about. I don't think it was only me being particularly thick. I mean, I think the point is that by repetition, it affects different levels of our consciousness, of our mind. So sometimes the mind is in a receptive space, is able to receive the teachings. Other times, maybe not in a very receptive space. So you can hear it, as Ajahn Chah would say, probably, you hear it with your ear, but it doesn't enter your heart. This comes across much better in Thai language, you say. You hear with your ear, but doesn't enter the heart as khao chai, my khao chai. Khao hu da mai khao chai. Goes into your ear, but doesn't reach your heart, you see. So even though you hear the words, but you understand it. And khao chai, enter the heart, in Thai means to understand. So you can hear the same thing over and over again, but does it really reach your heart to understand what it's really all about? That's the most important aspect of the Buddha's teachings, to understand it. So that's why sometimes some of these themes for reflection are very helpful, because we can go over them again and again and again, and maybe once in a while they seem to make sense to us, or they come together. So even though we hear the same things, it can be very helpful to listen to them with a receptive mind. And I don't know many of you, I don't know what your experience is, so I just have to kind of guess, hope for the best. But the teachings of the Buddha, of course, they come from different strata of our mind, different levels of our mind. The Buddha taught for 45 years to different people at different times, people at different levels of awareness, different levels of understanding. So fortunately, we still have this teaching available to us. And sometimes these teachings do have, you know, some meaning for us, maybe only at an intellectual level. Other times they have a much more of a deeper level, you can say more intuitive level in our minds. Even we don't really understand them very deeply, but maybe it resonates with us. Our heart does have some kind of response to it. So another one of Ajahn Chah's teachings was he used to advise people to listen with the heart. And this was especially helpful, I think, for at least for myself anyway, as a Westerner, because first of all, you know, hearing Thai language, I had to translate in my brain, you see, to English. I still don't think in Thai. So I think in English and translate, so sometimes I get a bit stuck. But the trouble with just hearing it with your brain, many times, because our brain and our sense of self are very closely related. You know, I think in a way which will support myself, so I filter it through my self-view. So you're listening with your brain, and you can notice sometimes this little voice in your mind saying, oh, I like that. I don't like that. This is good. This is not so good. It's all about the Dhamma, it's the Buddha's teachings. The little voice is coming from you, which likes it or doesn't like it. But if you listen with your heart, you hear something different. You can see, you can become aware of what actually resonates in your heart, rather than using just your brain to like and dislike and increase your sense of self then. You know, that judging self. It likes certain aspects of the teaching, some other parts they don't like. You know, when I give teachings in Western countries, for example, I'm very careful how to mention about the Buddha's teaching about suffering, about dukkha, because most people in the West have a little bit of allergy to dukkha. See? We're in this life for fun, right? We're here for pleasure. See? And yet, this is a very fundamental aspect of the Buddha's teachings. If we don't have some awareness of the universality of suffering, of dukkha, then we don't have much aspiration to practice. And I think for many people, even if they hear that teaching, even in the Western countries, they hear it in the right way, they can appreciate it. When I first came across the Buddhist teachings at university, when I came across this teaching about suffering, about dukkha, I was actually quite relieved, you know, because I was, you know, other philosophies, other religions, they talk a lot about love and light, you see. And when I looked in my heart, I recognized there wasn't much love and light there, actually. And when I heard the Buddha's talking about suffering and dukkha, aha, that made more sense than love and light. Maybe I'm just a depressive by heart, you see. But and I was very impressed with the Buddha that he starts off his teaching very, very, I would say, very practically. You know, starts off with suffering. He wasn't there to impress people. You know, if you're going to impress people, you don't start off talking about suffering. You know, if you go to a party and somebody says they're suffering, you immediately get away from them, right? You know. But if somebody says, oh, I had a great holiday, you want to hear more about it, you see? You want to join the fun too, you see? But the Buddha, he didn't really care what people thought of him. He just wanted to teach the truth. So he started off with talking about the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause, cessation, and the path. And I think that, you know, if somebody is in a receptive state, you know, if they have some, you can say nowadays people have, you know, a different kind of suffering maybe than they had in the Buddha's time. I mean, there were some people who were, you know, physically suffering. Nowadays, people have existential angst. Big word in the West, you see. You know, maybe you have a comfortable lifestyle, but there's some uneasiness. You can experience some anxiety and some uneasiness inside. You know, we all know, for example, at some level of our mind that we're all going to pass away. We're all going to die someday. Yeah? Not something we usually, you know, bring up into the forefront of our consciousness. Huh? We're going to die. We could die any time, actually. And here we are in Australia with all these creepy crawlies and all these poisonous insects and all these poisonous snakes here. I don't come from Australia, see, so I was a bit shocked when I read this book about Australian flora and fauna, you see. I was staying in some monastery near south of Sydney, And just where I was sitting next to the bookshelf, there was a book there entitled Dangerous Insects and Animals of Australia. So I thought, oh, I'll have a look at that. Wow, it was frightening. All the dangerous things. It's better not to read it, actually. Yeah, but we usually don't think about those kind of things, huh? Even though we know in the back of our mind somewhere we're all going to die one day. Are you ready for it? Huh? No, put it away, forget about it. But if we hear that mentioned to us, probably some people would say, yeah, true. Yeah, I can accept that. I can realize that. So what to do about it now? When I was in Thailand quite a few years ago now, Ajahn Kimavara said, I ordained 42 years ago, you know how old I am now. I think in my, third or fourth year as a monk, I was at Wat Nana Chat. And my Thai still wasn't very, very good. But this elderly layman used to come in every morning and help the monks after alms round to collect the food and offer the bowls and things. So this elderly man came in one morning, and I just thought I'd make some conversation with him. So I said, so Sabai Di Mai, how are you today? And he says, I'm suffering. He says, Bentuk. And then he laughed about it. He kind of chuckled, ah, ha, ha, ha. And I thought, what's going on here? Is he... Is he really, is he really being honest, or is he just playing with me, making a joke or something? My Thai wasn't very good to understand, very much. And then I began to reflect upon this, And this man, elderly man, was near the end of his life, and he devoted the rest of his life to come and help in the monastery, to make some merit. And I realized that, he recognized, the impermanence of life. He realized that he was on, the last phase of his life. So, but now being in a place like a monastery where he could hear the Dhamma and be of service, make some merit, he felt that he was doing something beneficial for his life now, even though it was still going to come to an end. And then when I could question him again, he explained that he was experiencing what it's hard to translate in English, but in Thai it's called Salok Sangvet. Anybody got a good translation of that? Salok Sangvet. Salok Chai is a little bit like a kind of existential sorrow. You realize the impermanence of life, the frailty of life. And in a positive sense, when you realize that, then the sangvet, or sangvega, in the Pali language, sangvega, a sense of urgency arises. You have to do something about it. And because he was in the monastery, he was familiar with some of the Buddha's teachings, he had some tools to use. I realized that, in a Western country, you don't talk about suffering or death or something like this because most people have no answers to it. There's no answer. But in the Buddhist teachings, there's not only do they point out, can we point out suffering and old age, sickness and death, but there's a path of practice we can follow. There's a way out of it too, a way to deal with it. We aren't just left with this unanswered question, oh, we're going to die, so what? What do I do now? There's a path of practice we can follow. So then it allows us then to acknowledge, aha, right, life is impermanent, life is going to come to an end, and I can do something about it. Yeah. As Ajahn Dunn was mentioning this morning at the mealtime, the basic Buddhist teachings, generosity, morality, and meditation, dana, sila, bhavana, here is a path prescribed for us, something we can do about it. Rather than just, lie in our bed and feel sorry for ourselves, I'm going to die. Oh, no, what will I do? Or go to a therapist. They don't even have an answer for that. What are you going to do if you're going to die? So what? You know? But the Buddha gives us an answer, something we can do about it, you know, a path of practice. Yeah. So that allows us then to open to this reality of life. You know, life is very uncertain. And I know, you know, living in a Western country, growing up in a Western country, that I know everybody has a certain sense of it. Yeah. They have a sense of the impermanence of life, the frailty of life, but they just hide it away, refuse to look at it. Yeah. When somebody dies, you know, I was at the monastery in Wat Nanachat is a cremation monastery. And originally the cremation, the men, whatever it is, cremation place was right in the middle of the monastery. The first thing you come in as you drive in the main entranceway is the place to cremate the bodies, you see, before you see the sala. It was the place for the villagers to cremate the bodies, you see. So this was also an opportunity for the monks to meditate upon the impermanence of life. And so when I was there in the early days, there were a number of people passed away. And we conducted the funeral for them, you see. So, but then I went to visit my family one time, and one of my aunts had passed away, and nobody wanted to see the body, you know, quickly put it in the ground, put dirt on it, cover it up, you know, forget about it. You know, my first visit to visit my family after 7 years in Thailand, it just so happened that, fortunately, that same time Ajahn Chah came to Vancouver, see. So I could meet him, and he gave some talks in Vancouver area. My parents went to see him. Didn't understand anything he said, but they remember my parents came to the talk at the university, and at the end of the talk, Ajahn Chah was getting up to go to leave, and then my father came over. And so I introduced them. I said, "Oh, Ajahn Chah, this is my father." And they're both about the same size, you know, like both near the same age. Yeah. So Ajahn Chah just held out his hand and said, "How do you do?" And my father almost fainted on the spot. if you admit Ajahn Chah, you can realize the power of his presence. The charisma you feel. And then to actually shook his hand, you know. He must have got like a spiritual shock. You know? But at the same time, just when I was there, my brother was getting married. Yeah, but I couldn't stay for the ceremony. I had to go back to Thailand to Khao Phansa to enter the rains retreat, you see. So my mother said, "Oh, you are a priest. You are a monk too. Do you do marriages?" I said, no, I don't perform marriages." She said, "What do you do?" I said, "I just do funerals." She said, "Oh, how depressing," she said, or something. And I said, "Actually, it's not. The funerals in Thailand are actually quite a joyous occasion. You know, I mean, people know somebody's passing away. Of course, there's sadness. They're not going to see the person anymore. But they go there and they want to wish them well. And there's like a celebration of their life. You know, the little children come up and say goodbye to mummy or daddy and put the flowers and the incense and the candles in the coffin. And, you know, people are sad that they're not going to see them again. Not this lifetime, maybe next lifetime, you see. But it's not a very depressing, not a depressing experience like it is in Canada. Everybody's wearing black, you know, and they bring the body out in a box and they put it in the ground quickly and cover it over. Rather than wish the person well, you know, say the person's passed away, well, they need all the help they can get. In Thailand, then they come later and they offer merit in the name of that person, they wish them well in their faring on in samsara, and they say, just like going on a long journey, see? Bye-bye for now, you know, I'll probably meet you next time. You know? if I don't make it to Nibbana. You know? But even though, you know, this kind of culture, I think, permeates, you know, the culture of Thailand because of this teachings from the Buddha. You know, okay, this person, maybe this lifetime, you know, they haven't made a lot of merit, they haven't succeeded in realizing Nibbana, you know, so what, they got another chance to come around again, you know, next time they come around, and maybe they have a better chance to practice. But the teachings are always there. See, fortunately, the Buddhist teachings are, they're the universal teachings. The Dhamma is always present. And maybe if you're really lucky, you come back with the next Buddha, see. And then you can hear the teachings and get enlightened very quickly. But don't count on it. Don't hold your breath. There's only one Buddha in a very long time, so we have to be careful, you know, not to count on that one. See? But the teachings are there all the time for us to practice, you see. And very at a sort of a simplest form, you know, every one of us has the possibility to be awakened, to put these to practice these teachings, to put them into our life, and realize the benefit of it. I mean, sometimes we maybe reflect upon, you know, the obstructions we have. You know, some people they undermine their efforts by reflecting upon the negative results. They say, oh, this lifetime, you know, maybe I'm born in a country like Australia. See, there isn't many monks around teaching me, you know. But a lot of people in Thailand, you know, who also live right next to the monastery and never even go there, you know. Or they go there once in a while, you know, and don't understand what's going on. You know, I know when I met people in Switzerland, some Thai people, and they would, you know, their husband asked them, you know, what is this Buddhism thing? They say, got to go ask the monk. You know? And then they come to the monastery and they see their wife bowing three times and they say, why are you bowing three times? My grandmother told me to. They don't even know that they're bowing to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Because they're little taught as little children just to bow, you see. Because grandmother said so. Why do you bow? I don't know. The grandmother said so. Huh? Even though they grew up in a Buddhist country like Thailand, you see, they still don't know what's going on. You know? So living in a country like Australia, I mean, at least we have the possibility to use the internet. You can study, you can read the books now, you can read the Buddhist scriptures in English language. See. Even in Thailand now, I think, I don't know about now, presently, but previously, Thai people couldn't read the Buddhist scriptures. Huh? Can you read it now? Yeah? It's been translated into proper Thai?
Not exactly.
Not exactly, right. Yes, yeah. Only in this, well, last century, I think, maybe, there was a translation from the Pali into Thai, but it was very, very high Thai. Huh? Very, very sophisticated Thai language, you see. So the average person couldn't read it. The average village person couldn't read the scriptures. Huh? You have to be well educated. Previously, only the monks could read it because it was in Pali, see. So we had to study Pali first and read the scriptures and then try to explain it in the local language, you see. And many times even the monks couldn't do that because, you know, unless you're very, very well educated and learned the Pali language, you couldn't read it yourself, you see. But nowadays, at least in English, we have the whole of the Pali canon virtually translated into ordinary English language. So, you know, you say, oh, I live in a place like Australia, very far away from the center of Buddhism, you see. But we have access to the Buddhist teaching still. And you can also look on the internet and you can find out where there is meditation retreats. I remember when I went to Thailand the first time, I was looking for a place to do meditation practice. I'd already been to Sri Lanka before that, learned meditation. So I thought I just needed a place, just find me a meditation monastery in Thailand. I heard Thailand is a place with many monasteries, many ajahns. So go to Thailand and you find a meditation monastery. So I remember walking around the streets of Chiang Mai looking for a monastery. Hundreds of monasteries, no meditation. Fortunately, I had the address of one meditation teacher coming to Vancouver. And so I wrote to him. And he said, oh, yes, yes, you can come to our meditation center. And when I first arrived in Bangkok, I took this address to the tourist office. And I said, do you know this monastery here, Wat Pleng Vipassana? Anybody heard of Wat Pleng Vipassana? Yeah. Tourist office hadn't heard of it either. I had the address, you know, Thonburi. Wat Pleng? Wat Pleng? Wat Pleng Vipassana? They didn't know where it was. They couldn't tell me where this monastery was. So when I was so noisy and polluted in Bangkok, I went to Chiang Mai. And so then I wrote to him, this monk in this Wat Pleng monastery, and he said, oh yes, we have many, many, many huts there for meditators. We have courses on. Many Westerners come there. You can come to our place, or there's a place in Chiang Mai you can go to. It's not actually a meditation monastery. It's just a very quiet forest monastery. This is Wat Umong, for those who live in Chiang Mai. It was actually a branch of Ajahn Buddhadasa, a branch monastery from Ajahn Buddhadasa in Chaya. Yeah. Anyway, I went to this monastery, and it was so quiet getting off the busy street. You know, those who've been to Chiang Mai, it's lots of streets with walls around the temples, and all these motorcycles rushing down the and all the noise reverberating through your brain. You see. But this was a quiet place in the countryside, out near the base of Doi Suthep, the mountain near Chiang Mai. So it was a very quiet place. So fortunately there was a German monk there who spoke English and Thai, and so he said, oh yes, you can come here and be my student. You know, so I could stay there and meditate. And the, you know, the only, like I say, limitation was that there was no real teacher there. It just was a quiet place, and I didn't really necessarily want a teacher because I already learned meditation, you know, my way. You know? I don't want anybody else telling me how to meditate. I know how to do it. So at least I had a place to stay anyway, and I could have the food left over from the monks in the morning and continue my meditation there. But after a few years, of course, you know, the limitations of that, you know, just listening to your own mind, you hear your own story over and over again, you see. And it's without having some guidance, some themes to reflect upon, some teacher to give you some instructions, then you just keep hearing the same stories again. So eventually I decided to go and see Ajahn Chah anyway in Ubon. And just going to his monastery was already like, you know, this is how it was in the time of the Buddha. You know, monks living in the forest, in little huts in the forest, meditating. And in those days, it was very quite simple living, 40-odd years ago, or 35 years ago or so. No electricity, no running water. The running water was the monks carrying the buckets of water. That was the running water. We had to haul the water from a well, put it on some big metal buckets, and carry them to the bowl washing, to the foot washing, to the bathing area. See, and of course, if you're really diligent, you run. I mean, you walk briskly. Nowadays, you just turn a tap. That's running water. Somebody came to the monastery then, and they offered Ajahn Chah to buy pumps for the well. He said, no, 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 the monks will get lazy, you see. We already had to walk, you know, 3 to 5 kilometers an alms round every day, you know, because Wat Papong was quite far away from the villages, a little bit closer in Wat Nanachat, But just being able to have the simple life, to meditate there, and then, you know, occasionally Ajahn Chah came to give some guidance and instructions. And like as I mentioned, he didn't always say anything, you know, so-called so profound, going through the same basic teachings over and over again, but occasionally they made sense. Oh, yes. And because the consistency of it, you know, this was also the teaching that he followed, you know, for many years now. He must have been a teacher been a monk for like 30, 40 years, and he'd been following these teachings all this time. And obviously he had some results from his practice. We can recognize that. You know, that here was not only when I was at university in Vancouver, I read some books about Buddhism, you see. I even took a course, comparative religion, so I should know about Buddhism. But then it was in the book, it was coming from your brain, you see. And then meeting Ajahn Chah, he was like a living embodiment of it. When you read some of these translations into English, some of these translations, they sound very, kind of very, very, you can say, abstract. They're a bit formal. You know, just like the word for anicchang, we translate it as impermanent. You know, how many letters is that word? Impermanent, you see? About this long. Huh? In Thai, they just say, my ne. Huh? Very simple, uncertain. You know? That was one of Ajahn Chah's most frequent teachings, I think. We would assume everything's permanent, you see. In English, you assume it's permanent, and then you have to say, no, it's impermanent, you see. So the kind of basic default is things are permanent, then occasionally they're impermanent. You know? They break, you know. So many times we get caught up with that attitude. Oh, things are permanent. We'll do this. We'll do that. We'll go like this. And Ajahn Chah would say, my nay. Ah, stop. That the main truth is impermanent. The main truth is uncertain. We assume that things are certain and going to work out this certain way. And, you know, I'll have my desires fulfilled. And he says, no, no, no. Uncertain. Kept reminding us, uncertain. So it's like having the rug pulled out from underneath you sometimes, you know. We just assume everything will be just like this, like the same tomorrow as it is today. Huh? My nay. And just having him remind us of that, you know, kind of, oh, right, yeah. You rethink, you reestablish yourself, and oh, yeah, right. And you can't deny what he said. Of course it's true. But you forgot. You just forgot it. And you started following your own, you know, your own delusions, your own wrong way of thinking, your own ignorance. You know, and then having him there sometimes to say, oh, uncertain, watch it. Wake up. And of course, yeah, thank you. I forgot. But of course, it's a matter of putting it into the practice too, you know. I realized at one point, you know, just by living near him for some time, that there was the danger of just sort of feeding off of his wisdom. You know, this is what also I experienced with the disciples of Ajahn Buddhadasa. You know, because Ajahn Buddhadasa wrote many books, so it was very easy to read his books and feel very inspired. You see, you can read these books and you think you know it. So you go around quoting, Ajahn Buddhadasa said this, Ajahn Buddhadasa said that, but how about you? What's your wisdom? What did Ajahn Buddhadasa say again? So living close to a teacher sometimes has a little bit of a disadvantage that it sounds so simple, so easy. You know, he's right there, the living embodiment of the teaching, and he's reminding you, you know, be awake. Be aware of uncertainty, impermanence. And it's very easy. You know, one time, you know, before the rains retreat began, there was four or five of us Westerners staying at Wat Papong at that time. And one of the monks who was there, a Western monk, he was an Australian bricklayer. Well, he had been a bricklayer. So Ajahn Chah got him to do some work building the wall around the Aposita Hall. And so because this monk couldn't speak any Thai, he got us to be the laborers with him, you see, mixing cement and carrying bricks and things. So occasionally Ajahn Chah would come over with some lukewarm Pepsi or something to raise our spirits. And then in the evening, many times we would just gather around his hut, you see. And he'd be sitting there receiving guests. And then I or one of the other monks could translate what he's saying to the other monks, the Western monks. And at one time, just sitting there listening to him teach, or even not even teaching, just talking to different people who came, you see. They were villagers came to ask him for some advice about their problems, and people from high-ranking officials in Bangkok came to seek his advice, and just sitting there listening to him explain the teachings. You know, I could sit there all night listening to him, just kind of wide awake. And then one night we came there, and he said, "Oh, tonight we're going to have a very short evening." He said, "Okay, you can now. We'll 6 o'clock in the evening. Okay, we're finished. We're going. I'm going to have a rest now. You can go back and meditate in your hut." So I started heading back to my hut, and every step away from his hut, I felt more and more tired. I got back to my hut and I fell asleep immediately at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I realized I'm just feeding off of his energy, of his charisma. I could sit there listening to him all night, but when I had to go and listen to my mind, I fell asleep. Must have been terribly boring. So I realized I had this thought in my mind, I must get away from him, actually, because this is dangerous, just feeding off of him, because he's impermanent too, And he did. He passed away. He died and passed away. And maybe some of the other of his disciples didn't really understand this, and so when he passed away, they also disrobed, They couldn't live without the master, without the inspiration of this great teacher. They couldn't live without him, so they disrobed then, lost the path. But fortunately, anyway, after 5 years of being a monk, we were encouraged to go on Tudong. That is, wander away from the monastery, find places suitable for meditation, quiet places, or visit other teachers. So after 5 years, I took the chance to go off and visit other teachers. Went up and spent the punsa up in the mountains in Chiang Mai and listened to my own boring mind for another. But at least I learned a little bit about how to be a bit more self-motivated. Because he was still there. He's still alive in those days, you see. So if I did feel lost or confused, and at that time he was, becoming a more well-known teacher, and he had quite a few branch monasteries, mostly in the Ubon area. Wat Nanachat is branch monastery number 19. And he must have had 30 or 40 branch monasteries. So, if he felt somebody, some of the monk disciples were depending upon him too much, he sent them off to these branch monasteries, like being sent to Siberia sometimes. Some of them were pretty bleak and pretty. Somebody offered some banana field somewhere on the Cambodian border, So it's a branch monastery. You got sent there, you knew, oh my goodness, I'm gonna will I starve first or go crazy first? But the main thing was, he realized he was trying to help you, see. It wasn't like a punishment. He sent you there in order for you to test yourself, you see. And some of the monks, of course, after a while, they got a bit lonely, or they thought they would get something, some more food better than bananas all the time. They can always go back to Wat Papong and stay there again and get some strength, get some confidence, and go back again to the branch monastery, you see. But and those who were wavering, who were very uncertain or doubtful, he would bring closer. Like this one this one Australian monk who was there. I mean, he was sort of a doubter type, you see. And then one night he didn't come to the meetings, you know. And so Ajahn Chah immediately said, "Where is he? Where is he? Go and call him. Tell him Ajahn Chah wants him." So he was in his kuti, kind of feeling sorry for himself, I guess, or something, or lacking energy. So Ajahn Chah, "You must come, you must come." So he came, and the first thing Ajahn Chah said, "Okay, give me a massage." And a little Thai joke here too. This monk didn't know Thai very well, you see. So he was going to massage Ajahn Chah, and he says, "Ka akat, ka akat." Ajahn Chah said, no, keep breathing, it's okay. It's a little pun in the Thai language here, because if you touch a venerable monk, you should ask permission, see. Ka okat. Ka okat, you see. But he didn't know it very well, so he asked for air. Ka akat. Anyway, Ajahn Chah was very forgiving. So if he saw that people were having difficulties, he could draw them in, and if he saw they were becoming very dependent upon him, he would send them off to one of these branch monasteries, and you knew you better behave yourself after that. So the point was that, you know, each person needs a different approach to teachings, you see. And some people, they benefit from many teachings. Yeah, their mind maybe is very, very busy. And so if they hear the Dhamma teachings, you know, quite often, I know some people, they're always listening to tapes all the time. I'm not a great fan of tapes myself, you know. But some people, they walk around the monastery. Where was I recently? Somebody walking around the monastery, they had their headphones in, you see. I assume they're listening to a Dhamma talk and not rap music. Whereas normally, you know, if you walk around the monastery, you should walk around with mindfulness, satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom. You know, so you watch, you're aware of where you're walking, you know, aware of the changing environment, aware of your changing moods. And ideally, I would say you shouldn't be walking around listening to Dhamma talks, you see. It's also a little bit, I would say, not very respectful either, because you should be in a right attitude, a right frame of mind to listen to a Dhamma talk, you see. Not when you're walking around, you know, going somewhere. You know. It's not a casual thing to hear the teachings, you see. But some people, I realize, you know, their mind is very, very busy, very distracted. So maybe they need to listen to some skillful teachings. Say some skillful, you could say, activity of the mind, you see. If they just listen to their own mental activity, maybe it's not so skillful. You know, all the worry and the doubt and the fear and things, not very helpful for them. So they end up increasing their unskillful mental attitudes, mental habits. Where if you change them to listening to some Dhamma teachings, maybe you hear something useful, at least you hear something which is, you know, skillful and wise, and it can change your attitude, change your way of thinking, maybe. You know. For other people, maybe hearing just a few words is enough, and more important, to put them into practice. You know, we hear about dana, sila, bhavana, you know, generosity, morality, meditation, and how many times you have to hear it before you actually do it. There is the understanding of what the teachings are, and then there's a putting it into practice. A practice of generosity. A practice of morality. You know? And these practices can be deepened, can be broadened, can be extended to all areas of our life. Especially meditation practice. This was something which, you know, normally, you know, for especially people in the Western countries, we hear about meditation, and usually in the context of a certain technique. Like nowadays, there's quite a bit of talk about the practice of mindfulness. Have you heard about mindfulness? Yeah, sati, mindfulness. Yeah. It's become a very, very, in some circles anyway, become a very common word. And it's sort of trendy right now, actually. And maybe, and I can accept that, you know, it does have some benefit for people, even they practice a little bit, you know. Because many times they're using this meditation on mindfulness, usually as a solution to some of their personal problems. You know, they like a lot of therapists now, some of the therapists use mindfulness training, mindfulness teachings to help people with their confused mind and their neurosis and things. That wasn't exactly what the Buddha had in mind, you know. Although, you know, it is a form of suffering. So the Buddha's teaching is to help relieve suffering. Of course, in the Buddha's teachings, in the context of also awakening, the only real solution to suffering is full awakening. And just practicing mindfulness isn't enough yet. But we hear about these teachings, and maybe it reminds us to at least try and put it into our life. You know, some of the people who came to visit Ajahn Chah, they come from different traditions. Like, it's very common for quite a few Westerners to go on the kind of spiritual seekers trail. See, go through India, and you do some yoga, and you do a few Goenka retreats, and then you go to Burma and do some Mahasi Sayadaw retreats, and that was a few years ago. Then you come to Thailand and ordain. Come to Thailand and find another teacher to follow or something, or teaching to do, you see. So many of them, when they came to visit Ajahn Chah, they'd already done, you know, a few of these retreats and things, and then they asked Ajahn Chah, you know, what's your technique? You know, what's your special technique you teach your disciples, you know? And one of the classic answers Ajahn Chah gave when people asked, what's your technique? He'd say, you know, the bell rings at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then you get up and chanting at 5 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, we go an alms round, you know, and then there's a meal wash up, and then at 3 o'clock, there's a bit water hauling. And yeah, but what's your technique? At 4 o'clock, there's a bell, and actually, that was at 3 o'clock in Thailand. That is the technique. And, you know, in the meantime, you're supposed to be mindful through the whole time, you see. Try and be mindful at 3 o'clock in the morning. Huh? Easy to be mindful after the meal, at least for half an hour or so, especially after sticky rice. But try and be mindful at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so he set up the way of life in the monastery to be, as it were, a meditation retreat, if you like. You know, and encourage people to try to develop this quality of mindfulness and concentration to all aspects of our life, not only when you're on some kind of specialized retreat. And in a way, it's even easier. It's easy when you're on a retreat. You have very, very few distractions, but, you know, try and develop these qualities within the midst of your own ordinary life. And that's the real, even like a kind of a test, a real challenge for you. But, you know, mindfulness and concentration, these are qualities. You could say at one level they're universal qualities. It just depends upon how we want to cultivate them. The more that we develop them, the more they gain strength, and they become then spiritual powers. They become factors of awakening, which was the title of my first book, which you forgot to mention. But maybe there aren't any copies left, maybe, or something. I don't know. Anyway. Oh. But we all have these qualities of mindfulness and concentration to some degree. But most people don't realize that if they're developed and cultivated, which is bhavana, meditation if you like, these qualities are developed and they can become spiritual powers or factors of awakening. But, you know, it's not a matter of just, you know, occasionally. You know, of course, being in a situation like a retreat situation, one can experience those qualities perhaps in an intensified form, then you could appreciate their value. If you have increased awareness, for example, not only are you more aware of your bodily sensations and your states of mind, then, oh, right. You know, and then you can notice maybe your old habitual tendencies obstructing that. All these, the old thoughts that come up, the worries and the fears and the doubts, and you realize, oh, aha, that there is a potential there to be the observer of this. Now, what's getting in the way of it? There's what you have to do the work, as it was, to do the work now to try and clear that old habit tendencies out of the way. And then the awareness and the clarity can arise by itself. In a way, you can say mindfulness and wisdom and concentration, they're the natural state of the mind. You know? But we obstruct the mind with all of our stories about ourselves. Huh? Lots of stories about ourselves. Lots of history, lots of memories, lots of blah, 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 right? Yeah, sound familiar? Mm-hmm. What happened to the mindfulness? What happened to the concentration? It's right there somewhere, you know. Somewhere, you just have to search through your thoughts and you can find it. But the Buddha reminds us that potential is always there, so... And the more that we can try and cultivate it, which is the real meaning of the word bhavana. Bhavana means development or cultivation, mental cultivation. We translate it as meditation, and then it becomes a technique or some little device we can use to get some degree of happiness. But it's a state of mind developing these qualities, making them part of our way of life. Maybe in the beginning, like having a retreat situation, can put us in touch with that potential. But the real practice is everyday life, how to keep those factors going. That's how we become, as it were, mindful and concentrated. Not just going on a retreat for a short time and then, we got it. Come back home and what happened to it? Left it on the retreat. I got to go back there again, you see. Take the next retreat. But these qualities are in our minds already. We just need to be able to cultivate them and keep them going. And so, fortunately, the Buddha gives us this path, the Eightfold Path to follow. So, practical steps. There is a path, practical steps to follow. So, you know, we're very fortunate to be able to come across these teachings then. And it's all available to us. It just requires our energy and our effort, which maybe for some people is a lot. Just requires our energy and effort. Yeah, but that's your part of it. The Buddha's done his part. He's given us the teachings and made the path very clear to us. Very logical, very very simple, very clear, just for us to follow that path and find out for ourselves. So this is what each one of us hopefully can be inspired to follow and develop and cultivate, and we see the results for ourselves. And not only within ourselves, but this has an effect in the world around us too. You know, when my father met Ajahn Chah, for example, you know, my father normally is very, very resistant to any kind of religion, you see. He said religion was just a racket, just a way to make money, you see. So I don't know if he wanted it as a way to save his money or it was... He was from Scotland, you see. So but when Ajahn Chah shook his hand... When I went back to my family's house after that, a few days later, the first time he asked about religion, he said, "Who is this guy anyway? What's he talk about? What's he teaching?" Even my father could recognize something there. You know, it didn't last too long. You know, just an hour or so, then turn the television on again. But. But obviously Ajahn Chah was a result of the practice. See? Somebody who had put those teachings into practice and found out for himself. And he had an effect upon other people, not just himself. I mean, in our Western context, sometimes it can seem very selfish. They were practicing on ourself, you know, for ourself. But the reality is that's where we start. And if a person does realize some benefit from the teachings, then people can recognize it, they can see it. So it has an effect on the world around them too, their family and their friends. I know people who have gone on meditation retreats and then they go back home to their families. And there was one person I knew in Switzerland, and when he went on these 10-day retreats and he came home. You know, I guess I think he had a little bit of psychic shock when he came back, you know, from his 10-day retreat and had to go back to the bank, work in the bank in Zurich. But at one time he came back and his wife said, "You know, you're a much better person when you come back from retreat, you know." Go more often. So fortunate. She was very supportive of his retreats, you see. So some people can recognize it. It does have a benefit not only for yourself, but for the family around you, the wider community around you, and hopefully even for society around you. Nowadays, society is getting very, very fragmented and very confused. So it's very important that there is somebody who's representing wisdom now, sanity and wisdom, mindfulness and wisdom. They can represent that and be a living example of it. And then hopefully you'll be able to not only experience for yourself, but it'll be a benefit to the world around you as well. So the Buddha's given us the teachings to follow. It's up to us now to put them into practice. So the rest is up to you. So I leave it for your reflection this evening.